American media is a business, and it has a mission. Not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with the capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive. It's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And it is a good day. This is Ryan Robson reporting to you from the internet for Monday, October 17th, 2011. And you are listening to Newsreel, the WOG global sit-rep on core political tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech today. And just by listening and distributing this program, you are too. Also standing up for free speech is Misanthropic Gods.
Follow these news stories and check our facts by going to the Rant Media forums and looking at our newsreel for a post with today's date. You get there by going to smf.rantradio.com. This would be a free broadcast. It can be heard on Rant Radio Talk, Galaxy 15 Radio, and recorded live in Second Life every Thursday night at 7 p.m. SL time at Grid Archers 155-74666. What we need most of all right now is your support. If you have something to send us, please email us at news@rostudios.org. Joining us live in Second Life today is Morp Sky Tower, Anthony Metaluna, Smurf Ort, and Legion Rosenman, and Anastasia Jenning.
Okay, so first up, everyone knows about the Occupy Whatever protests going on. I don't want to talk about that too much, since you probably all are well aware. But I just want to mention something here, is that it's come to Canada, there's some happening in Canada, and Mind Grinder from the Rant forums messaged me. Apparently he's going down to the Vancouver one. On Saturday, for those of you listening live, the Saturday just passed for those of you listening to the recording or on Rant Media. And basically he's just going to run around interviewing people, and Sims give him the go-ahead to represent Rant and stuff like that. So I don't have too much of an opinion either way on the protest itself for a Canadian side. So, I mean, if you're going down there and you want to bump into another WOG or whatever and you happen to the Vancouver area, then you can go look up Mind Grinder, or if this is after the fact, you can go try to find whatever he's recorded, assuming he didn't get arrested. Any comments from you, Misanthropic?
Nope, no comments. You know, just if you're going to go down there and protest, don't be a spoiled little bitch like I've seen some other people doing.
Yeah, if the cops start showing up and being dicks, don't be a hero. Leave. Anyways, run on to the news. In pre-crime news, thanks to the doctor, Homeland Security moves forward with pre-crime detection. An internal U.S. Department of Homeland Security document indicates that a controversial program designed to predict whether a person will commit a crime is already being tested on some members of the public voluntarily, CNET has learned. Now, of course, I hate referencing Minority Report because everyone does, but of course, the article forces me to do it. If this sounds like a bit... I won't say his fucking name. If this sounds a bit like the Crazy Magoo movie called Minority Report, or the CBS drama Person of Interest, it is. But where Minority Report author Philip K. Dick enlisted physics to predict crimes, DHS is betting on algorithms. It's building a prototype screening facility that hopes will use factors such as ethnicity, gender, breathing, and heart rate to detect cues indicative of malintent. The latest developments, which reveal efforts to collect, process, or retain information on members of the public, came to light through an internal DHS document obtained under open government laws by the Electronic Privacy Information Center. DHS calls its pre-crime system Future Attribute Screening Technology, or FAST. They love their acronyms. If it were deployed against the public, it would be very problematic, said Ginger McCall, Open Government Council at EPIC, a nonprofit group in Washington, D.C. It is unclear why the June 2010 DHS document, there's a PDF here, specified that information is currently collected or retained on members of the public as part of FAST, and a department representative declined to answer questions that CNET posed 2 days ago. Elsewhere in the document, FAST program manager Robert Middleton Jr. refers to a limited initial trial using DHS employees as test subjects. Middleton says FAST sensors will non-intrusively collect video, images, audio recordings, and psychophysiological measurements from the employer or employees, with a subgroup of employees singled out with their permission for more rigorous evaluation.
You know, again, this is something that can be manipulated, you know? I mean, you hear, accounts and books and stuff like that of, you know, things like this. I believe it was one of Cory Doctorow's books where they put, you know, where they had, you know, biometric cameras and stuff in the schools, and they, and it would, like, measure their gait, and that's how it would identify them. So they'd put rocks in their shoes to evade the cameras. So, you know, it's stuff like this. It's going to be, you know, eventually it's going to be used on the public, you know, regardless. We already know that this is going to happen. This is, you know, the ball-grabbing Department of Homeland Security we're talking about here. And, but, you know, just keep in mind there are ways to always defeat these. And this is, you know, keep in mind for the government as well as, you know, the citizenry. Just a little reminder there.
I personally don't see it as being terribly effective at actually predicting crime, because a lot of this data they're collecting here, like heart and breathing rates and stuff like that, sounds a bit like a polygraph test. And as we all know, polygraph tests and other similar methods of measuring truthfulness are bullshit, because they measure physiological response, which you'll have the same response if you're lying and you think you're getting caught as if you're nervous and you're not lying. So, I mean, this doesn't really detect crime, because, like, say, if I'm not going to commit a crime, but I know they're looking for people committing crimes using this data, I might be nervous enough to show up on their radar as, oh, look, this guy's going to commit a crime. So, I'm hoping that they don't actually deploy it widely and start using it in court and shit like that to get convictions and yank people and put them on a Paris watch list or whatever the case may be, because there's going to be a lot of innocent people thrown on this list. I mean, anyone with a nervous disorder could be thrown on this list easily, just by accident, without even knowing they're being watched. So, I mean, it's not very accurate at predicting crime. It might be a good indication that something's wrong, but beyond that, there's it doesn't give you any real data.
No, I mean, all that it's doing is just essentially, you know, testing out to see if you're, like, you know, stressed out, is what it is. Somebody with, you know, I don't know how they're going to measure heart rate, you know. I mean, that's something you kind of got to get hands-on for, you know, for the most part. But, you know, respirations, you'd be able to tell. But, you know, it kind of, essentially, they're measuring if somebody's stressed out or not, and that's how they're kind of singling people out, you know. And people are stressed out for all kinds of different reasons, you know. They're not going to be necessarily fucking terrorists, but I can kind of see why they're doing it, but again, I don't think it's going to be particularly effective. Because you also have to remember, you know, heart rates and breathing and everything else is subject to environmental changes as well. If it's a hot day out, you know, and people are out in the middle of the sun, yeah, their heart rate's going to go up a little bit. They're going to, you know, start sweating. They're going to look kind of nervous. They're going to, you know, be breathing a little bit hard if they're really, really hot.
And of course, the first thing I use this to enforce is copyright law in Copyright Craziness News. Publisher claims ownership of time zone data. The publisher of a database chronicling historical time zone data is claiming copyright ownership of those facts and is suing two researchers for repurposing it in a free-to-use database relied on by millions of computers. The data, which basically spells out past and future times anywhere in the world, is used in Java, Linux, PostgreSQL, Oracle, and other programs to assign the correct time based on geographic location. The researcher's publicly available database was hosted on a server at the Maryland-based National Institutes of Health, which apparently has removed the data at the request of Massachusetts-based publishing house Astrolabe. The publisher markets its programs to astrology buffs seeking to determine the historical time at any given time in any particular location worldwide, and claims ownership of data in its AC International Atlas and ACS American Atlas software programs. Astrolabe's federal lawsuit, filed last week, is among the boldest claims of copyright infringement since 2005. That's when Bikram Choudhury, a hot yoga guru, claimed copyright on his yoga positions. Choudhury had sent some cease and desist letters ordering studios to stop teaching what he claimed were his copyrighted yoga poses. In an out-of-court settlement, the targeted studios agreed that they would not capitalize off the Bikram brand name, but were not prohibited from teaching a style of yoga which was based off an art form thousands of years old, whatever.
Okay, you know, this is kind of bullshit here. The thing that, you know, most pisses me off, besides just this whole, for you know, lawsuit bullshit, is the fact that the NIH took it down before any legal ruling was, you know, done. So it was, they were requested to take it down, so they did. You know, and I really don't like that. I think that they should say, okay, well, if you're going to take them to court, we're going to host it until we get a verdict. If they want us to take it down, then we'll take it down. Period. If we're legitimately violating copyright law, then we'll take it down. But if we're not, then we're just going to leave it. That's what I think should have been done, you know? But I think that this copyright shit is getting kind of, you know, far, especially whenever it becomes so widely used. Yeah, I know that people are going to be making money off of it, and they want to make money off of it, but they're not going to get fucking money out of this, you know? Once it becomes so widely used, you can't get the cat back in the box.
Yeah, one thing that really pissed me about this specifically is, one, they're trying to copyright facts, like pieces of information that are true. That's what they're trying to copyright. If you happen to want to use this piece of information that happens to be true, you now have to pay them. That's bullshit. And two, this is not only a fact, this is a fact derived just from math. I mean, they're talking about, as far as I know here, they're talking about, like, different time codes around the world. So, if you know the current time, and you know the formula for getting other values of this type, then you could figure out the exact same information. They're just saying that they have it, so it's theirs, which is bullshit. That's like copywriting 4 if you use 2 plus 2. That makes no sense at all. Moving right along in censorship news, thanks to Jewel Verboven for this one. Italy wiretap law. Wikipedia hides pages in protest. Wikipedia's Italian edition has taken all entries but one offline in protest at a draft privacy law restricting the publication of police wiretaps. Transcriptions of his telephone calls have embarrassed Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi on trial for corruption and using underage prostitutes. The draft law would oblige websites to amend content within 48 hours if the subject deems it harmful or biased. Italian protesters wearing gags gathered outside Parliament in Rome. Sounds kinky. MPs have begun debating an amendment which would limit the right of newspapers and other websites to publish wiretaps during a police investigation. Restriction of freedom. Wikipedia says it may take down the Italian site, www.wikipedia.it, permanently if the law is passed. Amendments would have to be published within 48 hours at the request of the person making the complaint without any recourse to a court or independent adjudicator, which of course, as you know, would probably be impossible for a site like Wikipedia. In an open letter to its Italian readers, Wikipedia said, "The obligation to publish on our site the correction, without even the right to discuss and verify the claim, is an unacceptable restriction of the freedom and independence of Wikipedia." Mr. Berlusconi has said the law, which has been making its way through Parliament for more than a year, is needed to protect the rights of private citizens. Last month, Italian news sites published transcripts of Mr. Berlusconi's phone conversations, recorded during an investigation into whether the Prime Minister was being blackmailed by a businessman who claimed that he procured prostitutes for Mr. Berlusconi's parties. In one, he derided Italy and said he wanted to leave the country. In another, he used a crude insult to describe German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Mr. Berlusconi denies all charges against him, saying that he's the victim of a left-wing magistrates that determined to force him out of the office.
I'm really disappointed, you know, that Italy has decided to do this. I think it's really stupid to have censorship like this. I really don't like that they're deciding to do all these, publication of police wiretaps, restricting all that. I'm disappointed, unfortunately.
You know, Italy wasn't exactly the shining beacon of freedom of speech anyway. I mean, they were pretty good, except when it came to religion and the Pope, because of the Vatican being right there. Basically, what they're doing is just making it official policy now, instead of making it just a kind of thing that they do, which I can't say I'm surprised. I am disheartened and disappointed, but I really can't say I'm surprised at this. I really wish that they would move forward as a country instead of moving backwards into just covering the asses of people who are on top. in gun-grabbing news, thanks to Fat Ninja. Medical pot users fuming over ATF's gun sale ban. You can have your gun, or you can have your medical marijuana, but the Obama administration now says you can't have both. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives is in crosshairs for a recent memo prohibiting gun merchants from selling firearms to anyone who uses marijuana, including those with state-issued medical marijuana cards. An open letter dated September 21st from Arthur Herbert, ATF Assistant Director for Enforcement Programs and Services, said that any person who uses or is addicted to marijuana, regardless of his or her state, has passed legislation authorizing marijuana use for medicinal purposes, is not a lawful user or addicted to a controlled substance, and is prohibited by federal law from possessing firearms or ammunition. This didn't sit well with Montana Attorney General Steve Bullock, who fired off a letter this week to Attorney General Eric H. Holder Jr., saying that the policy raises serious legal issues under the Second Amendment and Equal Protection and Due Process clauses of the Fifth Amendment. The conflict illustrates the contradictory state of affairs between states and federal government on the subject of medical marijuana. 16 states and the District of Columbia have passed medical marijuana laws, a situation the Justice Department has agreed to tolerate despite continuing to enforce federal laws banning marijuana use. Where the agency draws the line is often a source of confusion. The September 21st letter was issued in response to gun sellers who asked the agency for guidance because buyers were showing them medical marijuana cards as identification, which is kind of fucking stupid. Mr. Bullock blasted the ATF for failing to consult with state officials before issuing the directive, saying that a cooperative approach would be much better than the type of unilateral proclamation represented by the ATF letter. Critics contend that the law unfairly discriminates against marijuana users because patients who take other controlled substances, such as OxyContin, have no such restrictions. In his letter, Mr. Bullock pointed out federal law allows those who are prescribed controlled substances by a physician to possess or buy firearms and ammunition. The policy puts gun dealers in a difficult position, says critics. Potential gun buyers must state on an ATF form whether or not they use marijuana at the time of sale. If they answer yes, they are denied purchase. But if they answer no, the seller cannot complete the sale if there is reasonable cause to believe that the person is an unlawful user or addicted to a controlled substance, according to the directive. The dealers have no way of knowing whether or not someone smokes pot unless they come in toking, says the Gun Owners of America Executive Director Larry Pratt. It's just one more way to aggravate the dealers and play gotcha with the dealers. They, the ATF, are totally out of control.
What I see here is this is pretty much the government, you know, it's essentially the ATF, you know, playing this petty little game with essentially, you know, states that have legalized marijuana, specifically California, you know, for medical use. And they're essentially, you know, saying, oh, yeah, well, we don't agree with this, so fuck you. We're going to screw you over with our regulations. So that's pretty much what they're doing with that, you know. And then this is also screwing over the dealers because, you know, I agree with this. The dealers have no way of knowing if someone smokes pot unless they come in toking, you know. I mean, everything else is, you know, basing it off of stereotypes. And unless there's, you know, unless, like, a joint falls out of their wallet, or if they have one of those, medical marijuana ID cards, then, you know, there's pretty much no way to actually know if they're, you know, providing the false information on their form. So I think that this is, you know, again, this is just the ATF fucking with everybody, you know, specifically California, saying, nah, 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 we're gonna screw you.
Yeah, this isn't terribly surprising either. It's, again, infuriating. Because, like, the ATF's just trying to get another stranglehold, so, one, they can crack down on gun dealers whenever they want, because at least some of these gun dealers are gonna sell, firearms to marijuana users. Maybe unknowingly, probably unknowingly, now that this, whole announcement comes out. But the fact that they did, the ATF will argue that they should have figured it out somehow, and not sold them firearms, which gives them their way to harass any gun dealers that they don't like or aren't particularly playing nice with them, but aren't breaking any other laws. And of course, this is another way to harass marijuana users. And so it's like, okay, even though you're legally allowed to smoke marijuana in your state, we're going to harass you to make you stop because we think you're a horrible, dirty drug user and we want to make your life hard. It's just another power play by the ATF right now, which, as anyone in the States who is a gun nut knows, the ATF has always been a little bit out of control.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure, you know. And, you know, this is just another negative, you know, more negative press for the ATF, which I think is kind of sad, you know, because they really could have, you know, a pretty good, you know, press presence if they wanted to, but they decide to keep doing things like this, and they're essentially just shooting themselves in the foot.
No pun intended. Moving right along into a little bit better news here, in space plane news. Pentagon's secret space plane could be astronauts' next ride. The Air Force's mysterious X-37B space plane is only on its second 8-month-plus orbital mission, ostensibly conducting science experiments. But manufacturer Boeing has already drawn up plans for a major upgrade to the nimble 29-foot-long robot, one that could be more than double the vehicle's size and make room for up to 6 astronauts. The enlarged orbiter, launched atop a rocket but capable of handling like an airplane, wouldn't exactly duplicate the awesome size and lifting power of the recently retired space shuttle. But with a big enough rocket booster, it could come close. That is, if the whole space plane concept escapes the Pentagon's deepening budget crisis. At a conference in California last week, Boeing program manager Art Grants unveiled plans for an X-37C that would be nearly twice as long as the current B model, with a commensurate boost in payload. A pressurized cabin would have space for 5 seated astronauts plus one on a stretcher, presumably for medical evacuations from the International Space Station. The C model space plane would be robotic-like, could be robotic-like its predecessor, or piloted by one of the astronauts. Once qualified for human flight, these vehicles could transport a mix of astronauts and cargo to the ISS and offer a much gentler return to a runway landing for the space tourism industry, Grant said, positioning the X-37C as a potential rival to Spaceship Two and other near-orbit vehicles being developed by a host of ambitious startups. The two 37Bs, costing around $1 billion apiece, are Air Force vehicles. What Grants is proposing is more in line with NASA's duties. The problem is, after 2 fatal space shuttle crashes, NASA wants its next astronaut transport to be a capsule, not a space plane. Capsules, being more streamlined, must shed just 5% as much energy as a winged transport while re-entering the atmosphere. This makes them safer. In any event, the X-37Cs could prove prohibitive in an era of government belt tightening. The engineering and certifying of pressurized crew compartment and life support system would incur eye-watching expenses at a time when commercial providers like SpaceX are supposed to be taking over the reins, new scientists warn. It is not clear whether a smaller X-37B would survive the budget crunch, according to hints dropped by Air Force's Space Command boss General William Shelton last month. I want to be that general, the Air Force Space Command general. It is very flexible, Shelton said of the X-37B, but whether or not it's cost-effective is the question.
I think this is really cool. You know, I really like seeing, you know, any you know, prospects of manned space flight for the United States advancing in the next 10 years is a good thing. And now, just a little curious thing about the X-37B is it was actually first designed as a NASA project. It was originally designed by NASA. Then it got taken over by the U.S. Air Force, and it went black. So it was all, you know, everything was done, you know, normal NASA procedure. It wasn't super classified or anything like that. And then the Air Force took over, and it completely dropped off the radar. It was kind of interesting how that happened. But, yeah, it's been, it's had a lot of press lately, and I think it's a good thing. It's, you know, had 2 flights, and one of which I was actually tracking live over the internet as they were tracking the ground track over of the X-37B on one of its flights. And that was really interesting. And then, you know, this X-37C, I think, is great. You know, I think that, you know, having that many people able to go up at once is great. And the fact that it's smaller and, you know, it's been designed recently, which is always good because it can take advantage of a lot of the technological achievements. And the fact that they say that it's so flexible is really good because it could possibly be able to be upgraded very quickly and keep up with the times. So I think that it's probably a little bit more cost-effective than the space shuttle, that's for sure, especially because it was using, you know, 60-year-old technology, and we really hadn't upgraded it very much, and this, you know, is a lot smaller, and it's a lot more flexible. So I'm hoping to see that, you know, maybe we'll get some manned spaceflight here up in the next couple of years.
Oh, definitely, for sure. I was sad when they retired the shuttles, because, I mean, the shuttles basically are space planes, and really, I think that's where technology has moved to, is reusable craft like that, which they apparently going back to capsules, because they are safer, but really, they're not as flexible, and I like this whole concept of a smaller space plane, because the fact we can still use capsules to move, like, really large objects and stuff like that, and use the space planes to move people, which should be more cost-effective. So I'm really glad they're at least trying to bring back the space planes. Might not do it. If they don't do it, someone else will, though. I'm really hoping they continue with it, because NASA fucking rules. In Asia,
you know, and one more thing here with this is that if you run a capsule, you know, you have to have a one-time-use rocket every time that you launch it. So, yeah, well, it may be safer. Again, you know, it's the cost-effective, you know, the space planes are reusable. You're able to save, you know, a large portion of it. With the capsules, you know, I really don't think that they're, you know, more than a one-time use thing.
Yeah, the capsules are basically one-time use, which is not a big problem I have with them. In Agent Provocateur news, thanks to the Doctor. Editor admits to infiltrating DC protests to undermine Occupy movement. An assistant editor at the conservative magazine, The American Spectator, admitted in print Saturday to infiltrating an anti-war protest in Washington, D.C., in hopes of undermining the Occupy movement, which, I don't think the Occupy movement is specifically an anti-war protest, but, you know, whatever. Patrick Howley, for journalistic purposes, was one of the anti-war protesters who clashed with security staff at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum on Saturday, leading to one arrest and numerous people being pepper sprayed. The progressive blog Fire to Blake has condemned the editor as an agent provocateur, and is unclear if Howley actually incited the clash with security guards. According to the conservative writer, he rushed into the museum entrance with only a handful of other protesters. Fire Dog Lake, apparently that's how it's pronounced. I can't really tell because it's all one piece of one word here, but whatever. I forced myself into the doors and sprinted blindly across the floor of the Air and Space Museum, drawing the attentions of hundreds of stunned khaki-clad tourists, he said. That sounds like a really fucking stupid idea. As far as anyone knew, I was part of the cause, Halley wrote. A cause I had infiltrated the day before in order to mock up and undermine in the pages of The American Spectator, and I wasn't giving up before I had my story. The mock and undermine portion of the article was later removed without comment after numerous media outlets, including The Washington Post, New York Magazine, and The Guardian, reported the story. The URL of the article was also changed. The protest was part of the October 2011 Stop the Machine anti-war demonstration. Okay, so it wasn't necessarily the Occupy or whatever. The protesters planned to demonstrate against the drone exhibit at the museum. Howley, conflating the anti-war protest with the Occupy movement, wondered if an ill-defined anti-corporate and anti-bailout protests were dangerous, but concluded that without ideological conformity and a willingness to boldly confront authority, the protesters have no political power. So basically, this guy was trying to infiltrate the Occupy movement and apparently went to a different protest, it looks like. So, he's an idiot?
It looks like pretty much this guy is an idiot to begin with for, you know, not even having the right protest, you know? And then he's also an idiot for being an agent provocateur, which, you know, he says, you know, he was trying to figure out if they were dangerous. Yeah, they're dangerous whenever you start, you know, doing stupid shit like that, you know? That's one of the problems that I see with a lot of these protests and stuff is they're open to you know, everybody, anybody can come down and can join the cause, but, you know, you don't really know who the hell is, who's there next to you, you know, and this guy, I think that this guy should have all of his credentials yanked. This was unprofessional, this was, you know, wrong, and I'm offended that they even bothered to print this. You know, I think that the paper personally should be, you know, distancing themselves with this guy. So it's, you know, a bunch of bullshit. This guy's a fucking idiot, and so is the paper that he works for. So don't read them.
Yeah, at best, this guy is a dumbass who had no idea what the hell he was doing. And at worst, this guy is an agent provocateur, basically. He's trying to fuck up someone's protest, and he's just too stupid to go to the right one. In surveillance news, thanks to Wyandi, FBI modeling news talk radio for investigations. If you call a radio talk show and get on the air, you might be reported by the FBI. Dun dun dun. The FBI has awarded a $524,927 contract to a Virginia company to record as much radio news and talk programming as it can find on the internet. The FBI says it's not playing Big Brother by policing the airwaves, but rather seeking access to what airs as potential evidence. Well, here's hoping they listen to our show. This doesn't give us any enhanced capability prying into or any Big Brother concerns, because this information is being put out on the airwaves, FBI spokesman Paul Bresson told WAML.com. It is very important to our investigators to know what's being reported. Bresson cites as an example the case of the Times Square bomber. It's ideal for cases like that because we can extract information that's already been reported to help our investigators make better decisions. Okay, that line's bullshit, because anything that gets to the news, they probably already have.
Actually, you know, on that vein, if you remember, there was that whole virus that was supposedly, you know, infecting the UAVs and stuff, the Predator and the Global Hawk, and, you know, all on the Raptor. I think it's Raptor. I don't even remember. They have all the birds of prey names for those. But Cyber Command, the U.S. Air Force Cyber Command, actually didn't even know about that until it was reported on Wired. So the Air Force actually contacted Wired and was like, they didn't actually contact Wired, but they mentioned in one of their press releases that they had no idea that it was being that it had happened until it was reported on Wired. So no, not always do they know. But, you know, I think that this is kind of a, you know, it's a common sense type of thing. This is being broadcast, you know, out on the airwaves. It's like, you know, saying it in public, you know. I mean, there's no real reasonable expectation of privacy. If you're, you know, shouting something out in public, you know, you're expecting people to hear it. It's the same thing with, you know, broadcasting on a news radio station or whatever. It's not, you know, I think it kind of sucks that they're doing this, but, you know, I mean, you're broadcasting out on the airwaves. You're expecting it to get listened to.
Yeah, FBI, if you want to know who the real criminals are, listen to our show, because we do a lot of news stories on stuff that's happening within your brotherhood organizations there. So listen to us, and you'll get some good evidence on dealing with that problem. Or, you know, lock us away forever, but whatever. In Thermoptic Cam News, thanks to Jewel Verboven. Researchers at the University of Texas at Dallas have hijacked one of nature's most intriguing phenomena, the mirage, to make an invisibility cloak that can hide objects from view, works best underwater, and even has a near-instant on-off switch, which there's a video in the link, and they fucking hit the switch, and goddamn, it works pretty damn good. To understand how it works, you first need to grasp the basics of the mirage effect. The unusual experience, sometimes seen in a desert or on hot roads during the summer, can trick your brain into seeing objects that aren't really there, or not seeing something that is there. It happens when a big change in temperature over a small distance bends light rays so they're sent towards the eye rather than bouncing off the surface. So if you see a pool of water in the middle of the desert, it's just the blue sky being redirected from the warm ground and sent directly to your eye. Your brain, being a clever little computer that it is, swaps this mad image out for something more sensible, a pool of water. With that in mind, the researchers wanted to find a material that has exceptional ability to conduct heat and quickly transfer it to surrounding areas to mimic the light distorting temperature gradients of the desert. That material, they found, was in sheets of, guess what, carbon nanotubes. The nanotubes, one molecule thick sheets of carbon wrapped in a cylindrical tube, have a density of air with the strength of steel. They're also excellent conductors, making them an ideal material to exploit the mirage effect. The electrical stimulation the transparent, yeah, through electrical stimulation, the transparent sheet of highly aligned nanotubes can be quickly heated to a high temperature. By transferring the heat to surrounding areas, a steep temperature gradient is generated, which causes the light rays to bend away from the object concealed behind the device. Therefore, the object appears invisible. And it does look like the mirage effect, but I mean, keep in mind, if you're using this in, say, like, a desert, then no one would think any different of it. It would look just like a mirage.
No, I mean, it's not about, you know, total concealment and being completely invisible with this type of stuff. It's about breaking up your outline and making to the casual observer, you know, it makes it, you know, blend into the background, essentially, is part of what it could do. So, that is fucking badass. I really like that. You know, I never would have thought that you'd be able to make this using, you know, Keaton and the same idea behind mirages. I think that's really badass. And I think that's, you know, really a cool step forward into the future of, you know, invisibility cloaks. Fuck yes. Hello?
It's your segment now, dude.
Oh. Shit. I'm retarded. Oh boy. Okay, well, moving on to Recomedia, because I'm retarded and wasn't reading the show format here. And we have What Really Happened in World War II, thanks to Jules Verboven. And got actually what really happened when E Company assaulted the German battery at Brecourt Manor, June 6, 1944, in France. Which is essentially D-Day. So yeah, you know, that's really interesting. Check that out. A couple of YouTube videos there. And we have fire control principles, which is the basic fire controls principles of gun against service target area when then applied to the control. What the fuck? This makes no sense.
yeah, I just copy and paste this statement somewhere. It's basically fire control principles applied to anti-aircraft guns and stuff like that. I guess it's handling incoming fire.
Ah, well, that's interesting there. And then we have a talk on science, pseudoscience, and crap, thanks to Jules Verboven. And moving on to Cyberpunk Kit here, we have new fully rugged cell phones. Sonim doesn't crank out smartphones. It's too busy flooding the Earth with uber-rugged feature phones, which most likely withstand an actual flood, and is darn proud of the fact. That's the impression we got, at least, after visiting the company's booth this week at CITA Enterprise and Applications. We had the opportunity to play around with Sonim's three new devices, the XP 1301 Core, NFC, XP 3340 Sentinel, and XP 1330 Core PTT. Announced on Monday, the first two phones are already available in the U.S., while the third is targeted squarely at Latin America over the next 2 months. Each phone will have a unique feature. The XP 1301 offers a near-field communications tag reader, while the XP 1330 takes advantage of the push-to-talk, and the XP 3340 Sentinel throws in a customizable man-down sensor that triggers an emergency alarm when something is awry. These are fucking badass. These are great. I really like this trend, you know? I like that this company's out here doing this because, you know, we're seeing a lot of industry, you know, moving towards, you know, really delicate smartphones and stuff like that and things that really won't take a beating. But what I want is I want a phone that can do a lot, but can be, you know, just, I could throw it off a cliff. I could, you know, run over it. I could do anything to it and it's not going to break, and I think that's really, really cool. And moving on to our daily hack. Hackers age 14 to 18 can compete to put their project into space. If you're between the ages of 14 and 18 and have a child who is, here's a chance to put a project into space. NASA is partnering with YouTube, Lenovo, and a few other entities for a contest that challenges participants to dream up low-gravity experiments. You can enter as an individual or in teams of up to three people. You may put forth up to three experimental ideas for judging. Getting in on the first round is easy as recording and uploading a video. You'll need to state a scientific question or principle that you want to test, the hypothesis of what can be learned, and a method for testing it. This is absolutely great, you know, if you have kids or, you know, if you're a 14 to 18-year-old listener and you're listening now, you know, check this out. You know, give it a good thought, you know, because you might just come up with something that NASA has not.
I like this trend towards encouraging the general public to think up their own research and science and technology and stuff like that, because there's a lot of people out there who are really switched on, but aren't in a position where they could easily use that in a real setting, like they don't have the resources. So I like to see contests like this. I mean, I hope that someone wins and gets a good job out of it, because that would be awesome. But don't worry, we'll be back next week to make sure you can get the news you need to survive. If you cannot contribute to the show, please distribute it. We would like to thank the Army of Flying Monkeys for assistance in gathering data. If you have any news stories or any pertinent information you want to send us, you can reach us at news@rostudios.org. That's news@rostudios.org. If you like the music in the background, check out the album At the Price of Oblivion, but which is a compilation from various artists. We leave you now with a title track from that album. Remember, everyone, we cannot defeat the enemy if you're at each other's throats. So until next time, that's what server said. End of line.